All right, good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So we're going to do something a little bit different tonight, although normally we focus on, in this particular shiur, the weekly parsha. Tonight we're going to focus a little bit on Megillas Esther, with an effort to try to really understand and appreciate perhaps some of the less often focused messages of the Megillah, the beauty of all of our Sifrei Tanakh, of the Chumash, of the Nevi'im, of the Ksuvim, is that the messages that are contained within the Sfan, they don't just relay a story, but they relay approaches to life. They relay incredible insights. So what we're going to try to do today is, by focusing on a part of the story that often is not studied, hopefully we'll walk away with something profound. So we begin with number one, which is the last chapter of the Megillah. Vayosim ha-melech Achashverosh mas al ha-aretz v'iyeh hayam. Achashverosh placed the tax on the land and on the surrounding islands. V'chol ma'asei takfo gvuraso parashas gedulas Mordechai, asher gidlu ha-melech, and all of the acts of his power and his might, and the full account of Mordechai's greatness, asher gidlo ha-melech, that the king elevated him, halohim ksuvim al sefer divrei hayomim l'malchei Madai uparas. They are all written in the book of Chronicles for the Persian Median Empire. The obvious question that comes up is, why is this here? It's very interesting to see that Achashverosh has incredible power. Remember, chapter 10, we've already seen the tension. We've already seen the potential so near annihilation of the Jewish people. We've seen the incredible, miraculous salvation. So the Megillah should have really stopped after the episode where Achashverosh tells Esther, go ahead, the house of Haman is yours. Mordechai is elevated to a position of power. And Gamarnu, that's the end. Why the need to add in this postscript about Achashverosh's power, about his expanding kingdom? So if you look at number two, so the Ibn Ezra writes, he says, Vayasa melech Achashverosh mas hal ha'aretz, if you skip it, take a look at the last line, Lohodia ki etzliach b'chol durachav, v'nirasa gvuroso, achar hayos Mordechai lo l'mishneh. So the Ibn Ezra and the Malbim do the same thing. They explain that the Megillah, in fact, is not telling you about the greatness of Achashverosh. Who is the Megillah telling you about the greatness of? Of Mordechai. What the Megillah is saying is something amazing. The Ebenezer points this out, that Achashverosh's influence has spread past the borders of his own kingdom. Suddenly Achashverosh has the ability to do something amazing. He has the ability to tax lands that are outside of his dominion. How can you tax lands that are outside of your dominion? Only if an incredible awe and reverence descends upon the inhabitants, even of faraway lands. People are so overwhelmed by the enormity of Achashverosh's strength and prowess that literally he's able to tax lands and faraway islands, even though they are not part of his 127 countries. Why, says the Ibn Ezra? Why, says the Malbim? Because of Mordechai. Because behind every successful king is a very shrewd Jewish minister. Says the Ibn Ezra and Malbim, that's what the Megillah is saying. Vayaser melech Achashverosh, why was he able to tax? Very simple, because of Mordechai asher gidlo hamelech. So in essence, according to this approach, the Megillah is not telling us about the greatness of Achashverosh, but rather the Megillah is telling us about the incredible accomplishments of Mordechai in the court of the king. In number four, the Vilna Gaon takes a different approach. The Vilna Gaon says much simpler, Vayasim HaMelech, Hine Ratzah Lahodia, skip to the second line, Sha'achar Shinitzolu Yisrael, Chazar Ha'olam Leminhago. The Gra says something amazing. Listen to the story of the Megillah. Incredible salvation, miraculous salvation, cloaked in seemingly mundane circumstances. Jews are safe from near annihilation. And what happens at the end of the Megillah? Taxes, says the Gra, because you know what happens? After the miracle goes away, guess what occurs? Life resumes as normal. Now, of course, what's especially dramatic about this is, remember, this is actually the second time in the Megillah that we've already heard about taxes. The first time the Megillah talks about taxes is that when Achashverosh selects Esther as a queen, as a way of introducing a period of national celebration, v'hanacha asa l'medinos, tax cuts. Tax cuts. So what happens at the end of the Megillah? I guess the Achashverosh era tax cuts expired, right? So again, no one renewed it. So again, so therefore the taxes are right back where they were. Right back where they were. So according to the Gra, what the Megillah is telling us in a very nuanced fashion is miracles are wonderful, miracles are fantastic, but in the aftermath of miracles, life returns to its normal cycle. So okay, take a look at number 5. But that's not the pasuk we're going to focus on. Instead, what I want to draw your attention to is the last pasuk of the Megillah. Ki Mordechai ha-Yehudi mishlam melech ha-Chashverosh. Mordechai the Jew is indeed the second in command to the king. The gadol le-Yehudim, he's great for the Jews. The ratzri le-Rov Echav, and accepted by most of his brethren. Doresh tov li-Amo, seeking the good of his people. The dover shalom le-Chol Zaro, and speaking peace to all their seed. Now there's one incredible statement that all of the commentaries pick up on, and that is Ratzoi L'Rov Echav. He was accepted, beloved, by the majority of his brethren. The obvious question, are you serious? Meaning Mordechai should have had approval ratings through the roof. After all, again, although Esther is hands down the heroine of the story, Mordechai is the architect of salvation. Mordechai is the one, again, who urges Esther to ultimately go before the king. Mordechai is the one who coaches her on many different levels. So whereas Esther is the primary character, the heroine of salvation, Mordechai is the architect of salvation. So we would think that if anyone was going to have incredible approval ratings, it would have been Mordechai. Yet the Megillah says, he was Ratzoi L'Rov Echav. Why? So this is very interesting, and here we see a variety of different opinions. If you look at number 6, the Chachmei Tzarfat, the French rabbis, in their commentary on the Megillah, write the following. There was a segment of the population that did not like Mordechai. Now, how can you not like Mordechai? Listen to this. They said about him the following. Look what Mordechai did to us. What did Mordechai do? He provoked Haman. How so? We were almost annihilated. Were it not that God intervened, and God has the ability to manipulate even the strongest monarchical heart. So the Chachmei Tzarfat says something amazing. There was a segment of the population that was angry at Mordechai. Why? Because remember how the whole tension of the Megillah starts. Haman demands that everybody bow. Now, leaving aside the midrashic overtone that there was some level of idolatry associated with that, the simple text is that Haman demands that everybody bow as a sign of respect to him. So what were 99% of the Jews doing? They were bowing. There was one person who wouldn't bow. And who was that? Mordechai. And the Megillah says explicitly that it irked Haman so much. We don't see any pre-existing hatred that Haman has towards the Jewish people. Not to say that he was a lover of the Jews, but remember, his plan to annihilate the Jews is a direct response to what he feels is the lack of respect given to him by Mordechai. So say the Chachmei Tzarfat, in the aftermath of the story, it's very nice that everyone lived happily ever after, that everything worked out. But Mordechai, because of your actions, we were almost annihilated. Why couldn't you just bow down like the rest of us? You know what the great thing about kavod is, the great thing about honor, is that it's free and there's an inexhaustible supply of it. So if some people just really need kavod. So you know what? What's the easiest way to deal with people who really need kavod?
Give it to them.
It's easy. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't cost you anything. So Mordechai, just bow down. The rest of us are bowing down. You should bow down as well. Yes, God came to our rescue. Yes, God orchestrated and manipulated events. But what if God wouldn't have come to the rescue? God doesn't always intervene. Sometimes God lets things play out as well. And what would have happened then? Chas v'shalom, annihilation. See, even though now at the end of the story, everything seemed to have worked out, there is this level of animosity and friction between Mordechai and some segments of the population. If you look at 7, Rabbi Moshe Chalai, who's a 17th century commentator, writes the following. Ratzri the Rovechav, he takes a different approach. He says, V'lo l'cholechav. So everyone's picking up on this same nuance, that Mordechai is beloved. Now, again, I want to point out, Rov, majority, is pretty good. But the question is, well, what happened to the minority? Why don't they like Mordechai? So Moshe Chalai says something amazing. He says, Ki ba'avor ma'aloso, Yivakshu men ha'kol. The truth is, we know, What's the first thing that happens when a Jew gets into power? Suddenly, what is everyone doing? Everyone's calling in their favors. Right, Mordechai, you know, if you got, you know, I parked my chariot in a handicapped spot, I got a ticket, you know, maybe you could help me out, you know, one Jew to another. So what happens is, says Moshe Chalayo, is that Mordechai is propelled to this incredible position of prominence within the kingdom, and suddenly everyone wants something from him. So what does Mordechai do? Ben kehogen, ben shelo kehogen. There were some requests that were legitimate, and there were some requests that were not legitimate. And Mordechai made a decision. He was not going to exploit his position. He was going to use it in an appropriate way. So if somebody asked something from him, if it was legitimate, he would help. And if it wasn't legitimate, he would not. Well, what happens when you don't do it and you don't scratch the back of another Jew? That tends to lead to some level of animosity. Therefore, says Moshe Chalayo, by definition, because he had to say no, apparently to a good number of people, this creates a sense of friction between Mordechai and at least some segment of the Jewish people. Moshe Chalayo goes on to say, lest you think it's because that Mordechai got carried away with his new position, that's why the Megillah goes on to say, Doresh Tov La'amo. He was very concerned about the needs and the good of his own people. V'dover shalom l'chol zaro. It's interesting that Moshe Chalayo explains, dover shalom l'chol zaro means he was the first to greet every individual, which is an incredible expression of humility. So lest you think that Mordechai's new position went to his head and that's why he was saying no, no! Doresh tov l'amo. Of course he's going to use his position for the benefit of the Jewish people. He's still greeting everyone proactively to go ahead and humble himself. But he's not going to exploit the position in inappropriate fashion. The Ebenezer writes in number 8. If anyone needs sheets, there are sheets right up here on the blue chair and by the bima. So the Ebenezer writes, he gives a simpler approach. He says, 8. The Ebenezer says, I don't understand. Why is everybody trying to figure out why only the majority liked Mordechai? From the Ebenezer's perspective, that's actually a pretty incredible accomplishment. You know why? Because no one has 100% approval ratings. The Chassam Sofer writes, he said that a Rav, if there's a Rav in a community, he said, if everyone loves the Rav, it means the Rav is not doing his job. If everyone hates the Rav, then the Rav is not a mensch. Right? So the Chassam Sofer says, by definition in life, if you're in a position that has to make decisions, there's always going to be someone who doesn't like you. That's just the nature. Look how low. When were Moshe Rabbeinu's approval ratings at an all-time high? When he died. Right? That's when Moshe Rabbeinu died, that's when he had 100% approval ratings. The rest of the time, I'm not even sure that it went above 50%. I'm not sure. So says the Ibn Ezra, Mordechai, you've got a robe, you've got a majority, you got 51%. That's incredible. We could count on one hand the number of people that have had that level of approval ratings. The people who have that level of approval ratings usually are people who are not in positions of power where they have to make decisions. Because, like, for example, this is the great contrast between Moshe and Aaron. Aaron is beloved by everyone. Why? Because Aaron is never the guy who has to say no. Aaron is the guy who is there for you, is there to help you, but Aaron does not have to make one decision that changes the course of history. So by definition, you never have to do anything controversial. If you don't have to do anything controversial, then everybody loves you. Says the Ibn Ezra, you guys are all looking at this from the wrong way. You're trying to figure out why some segment of the population didn't like Mordechai. Says the Ibn Ezra, that's psychology. Why some segment doesn't like him? Because there's always some segment that doesn't like you for some reason. But it's the shvach, it's a praise of Mordechai, that at least he carried favor with the majority. The Malbim writes in number 9, he says the following. He says, all right, we'll leave 9 and 10 for later. Okay, so far what we see over here, trying to figure out, why is it that Mordechai is Rotzei L'Rov Echav? Why is he only carried favor with the majority of the people? Why not the entire people? So far we've seen, again, a number of different approaches. Either because, again, people felt that he provoked this whole episode that almost led to their annihilation. He's not doing favors for everybody because you can never get everybody to like you. All legitimate reasons for why Mordechai has carried the majority, but not the entirety. But comes along Rashi number 11. And says something quite dramatic. Rashi writes, the Rov Echav, v'lo l'chol Echav. So Rashi, we're going to see, is quoting a Gemara that Mordechai was accepted by the majority of his brothers, but not by all of them. So what Rashi does that no one else discusses is, who was this minority that rejected Mordechai? See, everyone else just assumes it's some segment of the population. Rashi, quoting the Gemara, says, no, no, no. This is a very specific segment. Namely, who? Melamed Shepirshu Mimeno Miktsas Sanhedrin. Who was the minority that disliked Mordechai? His rabbinic peers. It wasn't the common people. It was his rabbinic colleagues that rejected him. Why? Because ultimately, again, he became very close to the monarchy. And as a result, v'hayabotel mitalmudo. And what happened? Remember, Mordechai, we'll see, was a member of the Sanhedrin as well. In order to go ahead and come into the service of the king, what did he have to leave? He had to leave the Beis Medrash. So because of that, says Rashi, his rabbinic colleagues rejected his choice because he chose to pursue a career with the king and leave the Beis Medrash. What's happening over here? Take a look at number 12. So Rashi quotes the Gemara. The Gemara gives us the fuller picture. So the Gemara writes, Ki Mordechai ha-Yehudi mishtal melchachash verosh, v'gadol ha-Yehudim v'ratzoi l'rovechov. L'rovechov, v'lo l'chol echov, melamid shepirshu mimeno miktsas Sanhedrin. So the Gemara says exactly what Rashi just said before. Mordechai is beloved by the majority of his brothers, not by everyone, but who was the segment that rejected him? It was the fellow members of the Sanhedrin. Amar Rav Yosef, listen to this. Rav Yosef says, Godol Talmud Torah Yotzia Me'atzalas Nefashos. Learning Torah is even more important than saving lives. Now, where does Rav Yosef get that from? D'me'ikara Choshev Le'Mordechai Basar Arba'o U'Lebasof Basar Chamisha. So what the Gemara then goes on to explain is the following. Rav Yosef goes on to explain is that Mordechai is mentioned twice outside of Megillas Esther. He's mentioned once in the book of Ezra and once in the book of Nehemiah. And in both of the books, he's mentioned in the list with some of the most prominent sages. But yet in Ezra, he's number 4 on the list. And in Nehemiah, he's number 5 on the list. He went down a notch. Says Rav Yosef, what happened between Ezra and Nehemiah? And Rav Yosef posits, Mordechai left the Beis Medrash to join the service of the king. So you see from the fact that Mordechai left the Sanhedrin and went to become Mishneh LaMelech, that he suffered a spiritual diminution, that he took a step down. And Rav Yosef actually faults him for this. Rav Yosef says that you see from here that learning Torah is even greater than Atzalas Nefashos. So first of all, that statement obviously cannot be understood on a literal level, because nothing's more important than saving a life, right? Saving a life sets aside everything except for the 3 cardinal sins of immorality, idolatry, and murder. So if you look at number 14, the Ben Yehoyada writes the following. He says, Vida dehodika amar yoser mehatzalas nefashos, lav hatzalas nefashos bevadai mamishu, dehavadai in dover omid bifnei pikuach nefesh. Rav Yosef is not literally saying that learning Torah is more important than actively saving lives, because nothing is more important than actively saving lives. So what does Rav Yosef mean? Achakavano al sofek hatzalas nefashos. Rather, what Rav Yosef is saying is like this. You know, in halacha, there's a concept of bari v'shema, bari adif, which means that let's say in a court proceedings, you could have 2 different claims, and one is a possible claim and one is a certain claim. So certainty always trumps possibility. So what Rav Yosef is saying is, Mordechai, we understand why you did what you did. Why did Mordechai, in Rav Yosef's logic, why did Mordechai take this position for the Mishnah LaMelech? Why did he take this position second in command to the king? Right. Because again, there's no active danger, right? There's no active danger, but there's always the possibility of what could occur. So Mordechai figures, you know what? Let me get in there now while it's still quiet. So should the fickle, unpredictable king somehow once again decide to sell us down the river and potentially annihilate us, I will be there to head that off the pass. That's a Shema. Is that going to happen? The truth is, you know, interestingly enough, historically, nothing happens between the Purim story and the rebuilding of the Second Temple. Nothing major happens. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that nothing happened? Or does it mean what? Maybe many things happened. They were just headed off at the pass because there was a Jew in the palace. We'll never know that. We'll never know that. But the point that Rav Yosef is making is, Mordechai, you know, you have two choices in front of you. You could go to the king, join the service of the king, because of a potential threat, or you could stay with the Sanhedrin, stay in the Beis Medrash, which is a definite. A definite what? A definite that you'll contribute to your people, you'll grow spiritually, you'll advance the spiritual agenda of Klal Yisrael. So Rav Yosef says, I'm sorry, Mordechai, you made the wrong decision. Bari v'shema, when there's a possibility and a certainty, which one wins? The certainty. The Bari wins. So that's Rav Yosef. So again, according to the Gemara over here, something amazing is unfolding. According to the Gemara, the source of friction between Mordechai, and this minority, first of all, is not just any minority. It's a very significant minority. Why? Because it's the leadership. It's Mordechai's peers. They are the ones who break ranks with Mordechai. Why? Because they feel he has made a terrible error in leaving the Sanhedrin, leaving the Beis Medrash, and going to join the service of the king. So the question we have to ask ourselves over here is, what is going on here? So what, is they're upset because he took a different job? They couldn't understand why he would have done this, meaning to us, it's very logical why Mordechai might have felt compelled to do this. What is the Nekudas HaMachlokis? What is the fundamental dispute that's occurring here between Mordechai and his colleagues? So if you take a look at number 15, what's amazing to note is the Gemara Maseches Chulin says, Esther min HaTorah minayin. Right? Where do we see a scriptural allusion to Esther? Obviously, there's nothing written about Esther in the Torah because Esther occurs after the close of the Torah. But often the Gemara does this where the Gemara tries to find a scriptural allusion. Give me a hint. Give me a hint that Esther is referred to in the Torah. So what does the Gemara say? Quotes from the Tochacha. Quotes from the series of curses in Devarim. What does the Torah say? Va'anochi hastir astir. I will hide my face. I will conceal and hide myself. So the Gemara understands. Now again, that's not just a play on words. What the Gemara is saying is, if you want to see the biblical allusion to the book of Esther, to the story of the Megillah and the Torah, look in the parasha of Hester Panim, of where God hides his face. Now of course, so we say to ourselves, well of course, that's obvious, because remember, who's not mentioned in the Megillah? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But understand, there's something much more profound unfolding over here. Take a look at number 16. So we did this paragraph in the Women's Tehillim Shir last week. So for those who are there at that shir, this will be a little bit of review, just this first paragraph. Then we'll move on to newer things. So the Rav writes the following. The Rav says, the Megillah contains the story of events that occurred in the twilight hour of Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day full of song, color, and joy. A day on which God's word was on many tongues and his spirit in many hearts. It ushers in a dark, dreary, autumnal night of silence and fear. A night in the course of which God stopped speaking to his people. At that time, the covenantal community was losing, slowly but surely, the most precious of all gifts, prophecy. The great covenantal dialogue between man and God that had commenced with Abraham was about to be terminated. And the prophetic community faced a stark, ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence. With the transition from a prophetic to a non-prophetic community, the Jewish historical experience changed completely. So Soloveitchik points out something that is absolutely jaw-dropping. Do you know what the amazing aspect of Megillas Esther is? Megillas Esther is the first book of Tanakh in what the Rav calls the post-prophetic era. It's not just God who's missing from, it is God that's missing from the Megillah, but you know what else is missing from the Megillah? There's no prophet. And if there's no prophet, what else is missing? There are no instructions. No instructions. Says the Rav, if we look at all of the Chumashim and the Sifrei Nach until this point, they are all categorized by the same dynamic. Vayedaber Hashem el fill in the blank, wherever it is, lay more. God is speaking to the prophet. Prophecy is the guiding light. What does the Jew do when I'm in a situation that I don't know what's happening? What does the Jew do when I don't know which way to turn? What do? We ask the prophet. We ask God. And God communicates explicit directions to the prophet. In paragraph B, the Rav goes ahead and in fact contrasts the leadership of Mordechai and Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu's job was to be a leader, correct? Legabe Klal Yisrael. But his job vis-a-vis God was to be a good soldier. Moshe Rabbeinu's entire career is scripted. God tells him, go here, do this, say this. In fact, if you remember again, one of the most dramatic moments is when the Jewish people are standing by the banks of the Yam Suf. And although the Torah does not say it explicitly, we see from God's response that Moshe Rabbeinu is calling out to God in supplicative prayer. God help us. And what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say to Moshe Rabbeinu? Ma titzakilai. Why are you that? What do you mean? What do you mean? Why am I davening? What else does the Jew do in a time of distress? That's how we get that from the Avos. What do you mean, Matitzakilai? So God says to Moshe, I don't understand. I give you the instructions. You don't have to daven. You don't have to ask. I'm going to tell you what to do. I told you to go. That's all there is to this process. In fact, the one time that Moshe Rabbeinu does not follow the script, it ends with disastrous results. And when is that? By May Meriva. When he hit the one time, Moshe Rabbeinu only goes off script one time. And it disastrous results for Moshe and for the Klal. The Rav writes, Moshe Rabbeinu lived a scripted existence. Mordechai, on the other hand, look what the Rav writes. Take a look at the last couple of lines in paragraph B. It was left to him, Mordechai, in contrast to this kind of agency, received not a clearly defined, but a multifaceted mandate. It was left to him how to interpret and implement this mandate. Mordechai was confronted with a number of alternatives. The choice was his. He exercised free judgment. In Egypt, God acted, man was an onlooker. In Persia, God summoned man to act freely and wisely under God's supervision and watchful eyes. Sehidrov says something absolutely dramatic. In Egypt, God was the primary character. Man was the agent of God for the actualization of the plan of God. In Persia, God is seemingly nowhere to be found. So how does Mordechai decide what to do?
He does.
Look at letter C. How can the Jew triumph over his adversaries and enemies if God has stopped speaking to him? If the cryptic messages he receives remain unintelligible and incomprehensible. So the Rav says, so how do you make this transition? How do you go from the prophetic era? Well, now again, it's hard for us to relate to this because we've been for the last 2,000 years plus in the post-prophetic era. But think about it. Mordechai is living in a generation of transition. Mordechai saw prophets. Mordechai heard prophets. And now, so how does man navigate in the post-prophetic world? So look what the Rav writes. The answer to this is to this question is more a statement of fact than an explanation. Even during the non-prophetic era, at a time when divine countenance is hidden, Hester Panim, man is elected by God to carry on, to make decisions, to undertake difficult tasks courageously, and implement them superbly. Of course, it is a superhuman task, he switches now to Esther, for a young, inexperienced maiden. However, the Spirit of God will descend on her and inspire her to defy danger and make the right decisions. God asks of man to reach maturity and independence. Underline that line. In the post-prophetic world, God asks of man to reach maturity and independence. He wills man to act with courage and wisdom, allegedly as his own master. Now again, the Rav adds in that allegedly as his own master, because lest you think that in the post-prophetic age, God is not pulling the strings, that's not true. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always the choreographer for everything that goes on in our world, in our lives. But in the post-prophetic era, God demands of man maturity and independence. Or in other words, you know what the mandate in the post-prophetic era is? It's four words, very profound words. You ready? Four. Go figure it out. That's the mandate in the post-prophetic era. Don't look upward. Don't look for the prophet. Don't look for the word of God. Instead, in the prophetic era, we look upward. In the post-prophetic era, we look inward. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells man to be mature, to be independent, and you have to try to figure out and navigate these particular circumstances. So now we begin to understand what is unfolding over here in the Megillah. So what's happening here? What's happening over here is the following. The story's over, right? Not the story's over. The tension is over. We've been saved. Salvation. So now everybody's got to resume normal life. What was the expectation of Mordechai? What was the expectation that others had of him? Where was he going to go? He was going to come back to the Sanhedrin. Right? He was going to go ahead, you did your part, what you need to do in the world, come back into the Jewish community. And yes, Mordechai would have been a great leader. And serve the needs of your people. And what does Mordechai say to himself? Mordechai says, I feel like I have to make a different decision. I feel that in this brave new world, things have to occur differently. Mordechai, what are you basing that decision on? Right? What Rebbe did you speak to? Who did you consult? What Eitzah did you get? And Mordechai says, I just feel it inside. I'm taking my maturity and my independence, and this is what I feel I have to do in these circumstances. You understand what's happening in life. In general, when we make decisions, so all of our decisions are always based on what? Decisions are based on past experience, right? When I make a decision in life, whether I'm consciously aware of it or not, the decision I make for the present is based on a composite of all of my life experiences until this point. That's why often, when do we really get sideswiped by a life situation? When we have no experience with it, right? When something happens which I have never experienced before, very often it takes people by surprise and they don't immediately have the coping mechanisms or the skills to deal with it because I've never encountered this before. Then ultimately we catch up with the situation. So that's what's happening over here. For the first time, people have to make dramatic life decisions on their own. So Mordechai's peers feel that the right decision is to do what? The right decision is to keep on doing that which we have done until this point. Right? The right decision is serve the needs of our community. You ventured out for a necessary time. Now you must come back in. Now you must withdraw back into our world. Resume your role in the Sanhedrin. Resume your role in the Beis Medrash. Serve the needs of your community. And Mordechai says, my dear friends, we're not living in the same world anymore. In this world, God charges us with trying to figure it out. God charges us with being independent. God charges us with being mature. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to, yes, go figure it out. And sometimes what that requires of us is to make decisions that have never been made before. And you know what happens when you make a decision that's never been made before? Right? There are mistakes, and there's almost always resistance. Because the first time that anything new happens, there is always going to be resistance. Because again, anything new, when it first occurs, is always considered to be a break with tradition. And the truth is, you could take the very things that are part and parcel of our religious fabric today, which at some point in time, you know, whether it's Hasidus, whether it's Beis Yaakov, whatever it is, and its inception was considered revolutionary. And its inception by some was actually considered to be apikorsos, was considered to be heresy. But what happens? In the post-prophetic era, different times require incredibly difficult decisions. New decisions, innovative decisions, mature decisions, independent decisions, and those decisions always meet with some level of resistance to begin with. In fact, take a look at number 17. The Gemara Maseches Chulin says something amazing. Mordechai min HaTorah minayin. So after the Gemara says, where do we find a scriptural allusion to Esther? The Gemara then asks, where do we find the reference to Mordechai? So the Gemara says something very interesting. Actually, it's amazing how this works out. This is this week's parsha. Dichsiv mar deror. So if you take a look, it's quoted from the Pasuk in number 18, by the Shemen HaMishkan, the anointing oil. So the anointing oil of the Mishkan that was used to anoint all of the utensils, and also the Kohen Gadol, as well as later on the Melech, the king, that oil was made of a number of different spices. So the Gemara says, for example, the Torah says, Va'ata kach lecha b'samim rosh mar diror. Take for yourself fine spices, mar diror. What's mar diror? So mar diror is fine myrrh. Fine myrrh. Myrrh is a kind of spice. So the Gemara says, where do you see a scriptural allusion to Mordechai? In the words, mar deror. Because in Unkelus, which is the Aramaic commentary on the Torah, mar deror is translated as mara dachya. Mara dachya, when you put them together, becomes Mordechai. So the Gemara here is actually using this not just as a reference to Mordechai, but to the piety and the righteousness of Mordechai. That Mordechai's name is found in the highest level of spices made for the Shemen HaMishcha. But there's something interesting because the word Dirar is also used in a different context. Where is the word Dror used? Take a look at number 20. In the Pasuk by Yovel, by the Jubilee year. By the Jubilee year. So the Torah says, the year number 50 in the agricultural cycle, Ukrasem Eshnasa Chamishim Shana, Ukrasem Dror Ba'aretz L'chol Yosheveha. So in the 50th year, what will you do? You will call out a Dror. Now what does Dror mean? So if you take a look at 21, the Ibn Ezra writes, Yedua V'hu Kimo Chofshi. Dror means freedom. You will declare freedom. You will declare freedom in the 50th year. Freedom for the slaves. There's something very interesting. So yes, Mar Dror is fine myrrh. But you know what it also means if we define the words literally. So Mar means what?
Bitter.
Dror means freedom. So what does bitter freedom mean? That sometimes in life, you have to make your own decisions. You have to exercise the freedom of making your own decisions. And you know what? Sometimes that is not a pleasant experience. Sometimes it's bitter. You know why it's bitter? Because sometimes, maybe even often, we make mistakes. And sometimes when you make those decisions, they fracture relationships because others don't like the decisions that we make. Dror, incredible life freedom, the ability to be mature and take responsibility over the direction and trajectory of our life, is very often mar, is very often difficult, is very often laced with incredible setbacks, failures, and frayed relationships. So here we understand, seriously, what's happening over here. So Mordechai feels himself at a crossroads. If you're Mordechai, what do you want more than anything? What do you want more than anything? The one thing you're never going to have, which is all you want, just give me a Navi for 5 minutes. Hey, just give me a prophet. Just go ahead and give me a prophet who could help me go ahead and figure out what it is that I need to do in this circumstance. But that one thing that he wants more than anything is the one thing that he will never find that we have not had to this day. So what do you do when there's no prophet? What do you do when there's no God? No, excuse me, when there's no God present? What do you do in the post-prophetic era? You figure it out. You exercise maturity, you exercise independence, and you make your decision. I want to show you something very interesting. Look at 22. And this is going to forever change your conception of the Megillah. The Al-Sheikh HaKadosh writes the following. The Al-Sheikh writes, and this is amazing. He says, L'ze Amar, Al Ya'ala Aruchacha, Shebehiyosom Mishnah Melchachashverosh, Bitel, So the Al-Sheikh says, I'm sorry, even Rav Yosef in the Gemara, I think you have the narrative wrong. I think the way everybody's framing it is that Mordechai has left the Beis Medrash, Mordechai has left the Sanhedrin, and he has chosen to become the second in command to the king. So the Al-Sheikh says, no. Ki halo am shemordechai ha-Yehudi, im shemordechai ha-Yehudi, Mishnah, im kol zeh, So the Al-Sheikh says, you're not reading the Pasuk. What does the Pasuk say? Ki Mordechai ha-Yehudi, Mishneh le-Melech ha-Chashverosh. Yes, he is the second in command to the king. But what does the Megillah say immediately afterwards? The Megillah says, the Gadol le-Yehudim. What does it mean, Gadol le-Yehudim? Gadol le-Yehudim means he was a Gadol. He was great for the Jewish people as well. Says the Al-Sheikh, what's the raya, what's the proof to that? Because what does it say next? V'ratzui l'rovechav. You know how he was ratzui l'rovechav? So the Al-Sheikh goes on, he quotes the Gemara that says, Shederech Talmud Chacham hu, this sunny lay b'nei Masya. A Talmud Chacham, a rabbi, a judge, is very often disliked by the members of his community. Why? Because the truth is, for this one, you told him that the chicken's not kosher, that causes him a loss, right? This one, you paskin against him in Beis Din, lost. This one, the drasha was too long on Shabbos. Whatever it is, there's always reasons why you end up alienating people. So the Al-Sheikh says something amazing. The fact that Mordechai was Ratzui L'Rov Echav, which means that there was a segment that didn't like him, says the Al-Sheikh, points to the fact that what? That he was still involved in the matters of community. What the Al-Sheikh writes is the following. You're all making a mistake. You think that it has to be an either or. That either you're the Mishneh LeMelech or you are the Gadol Yehudim. That either you're sitting in the Sanhedrin or you're sitting in the palace. And the Al-Sheikh says, why can't it be both? Why can't the same individual be an exceptionally pious Talmid Chacham, influential Jew, who shapes the nature of his community, while at the same time having a hand in the affairs of the world around him? You know, the Rav points out that when Yosef has his two dreams, remember again, in Yosef's first dream, he dreams about sheaves of wheat bowing down to him. And then in his second dream, he dreams about sun, moon, and stars bowing down to him. So it's interesting, the Rav points out, I should have put this on the sheet, the Rav points out that there's a different reaction from the brothers to both of the dreams. Right? In the first dream, so the brothers go ahead and are more dismissive of the dream of Yosef. Hamaloch timloch aleinu, who are you? In the second dream, it says what? That they hated him. So the Rav says, why do they hate him after the first dream? After the second dream and after this first dream? So the Rav says something amazing. The Rav says, the sheaves of wheat represent material superiority. Yosef's going to be more materially successful than us. So the brothers hear this, all right, fine, he's going to have more money. Okay, fine. So it's annoying because it's a younger sibling just being irresponsible the way he presents himself, but fine. But what does the second dream represent? The second dream of the sun, moon, and stars, says Rav, what is the sun, moon, and stars? That's spirituality. And what Yosef was dreaming was about spiritual superiority. When you put those two dreams together, says the Rav, the dreams of Yosef was that Yosef was going to be able to eat, as they say, at both tables. He was going to be materially and societally accomplished, but at the same time, he was going to reach the pinnacle of the sun, the stars, and the moon. He was going to be accomplished in the eyes of the world, and he was going to be accomplished in the eyes of God. And when the brothers heard that, they said, that's ridiculous. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You can't have the wheat, and you can't have the stars. You want to have a lot of wheat? But you're not going to be in the stars. You want the stars? Get ready to give up the wheat. And Yosef, not even realizing what he was prophesizing at, was saying no. In fact, the Jew has the koach to be able to have both. And that's what's unfolding over here. So Mordechai feels that, yes, is this a dramatic decision? It's an exceptionally dramatic decision. Is it a decision that has ever happened before? The truth is, it happened before when, as we just quoted, by Yosef. The difference with Yosef is, remember, Yosef didn't choose his situation. Yosef was thrust into his situation. Is Mordechai the first person that ever actively chooses to venture into the outside world? Yes. Why? Because up until now, we were an autonomous nation in the land of Israel. There was the outside world was our world. Mordechai is the first person to have to contemplate this type of decision. And says the Al-Sheikh, what Mordechai is able to do is something that no one since Yosef has done, which is he was able to master both worlds. He was able to be the Mishnah LeMelech, but he was also able to be the Gadol Yehudim. He sat in the court of the king, and he sat at the head of the court of the Jews. Is it difficult? Of course, it's always easier to live life in black and white. It's always easier to say, mutter, aser, kosher, treif, tamei, tar. That's always easier to do black and white. But says what we're seeing over here is the world is not black and white. Most of the world, in fact, is gray. And the gray, there's so much gray in the post-prophetic era. And it's the job of the Jew to try to figure out, how do I navigate in the world of gray? I have to be mature. I have to be independent. I have to make decisions. And very often my decisions, I have to look inward and try to make the right ones. Do I always make the right ones? Of course not. Very often I fail. And I just have to start the entire process again. Was Mordechai right or wrong in his decision? This is the great challenge of the post-prophetic era. We don't know. You know what? Maybe he was right, and maybe he headed off much danger at the pass. Or maybe he was wrong, and maybe he could have been the next Moshe Rabbeinu had he stayed solely in the Sanhedrin and not delved into the matters of the affairs of state. But the truth is, in the post-prophetic era, We often don't get, you know, a scorecard from the Ribono Shel Olam that says, good job, needs improvement, fix your attitude, you know, unprepared with books and materials. You know, we don't get that from the Ribono Shel Olam. It would be wonderful if we did get it. But in the post-prophetic era, very often, we have to just wonder, I think I made the right decision, or I made the right decision at the time that I made it, given the circumstances. Was it the best decision? That we don't know. But what's important is that we always maintain the courage to be mature, to be independent, and to make those decisions. Because the danger of living in the world of gray is that very often it scares people off from making decisions. Because the truth is, no one wants to be wrong. No one wants to be wrong. I want to do good. So sometimes when we're faced with the reality that maybe good is not obvious, or maybe the right decision is not easy, sometimes that leads people to inaction. And there's one thing that's clear, which is inaction is always the wrong decision. That's clear. And I would venture to say even a step further, a bad decision is very often better than no decision. Because a bad decision at least is movement. No decision is stagnation. This is the fundamental dispute that's unfolding over here in the aftermath of the Purim story. Haman's gone, the Jews are safe at least for now, Mordechai's peers, let's revert back to the model that we've known until now. Mordechai says, I'm sorry, there's something in me that just says I can't do it. The Alshich, the greatness of Mordechai is he was able to wear both crowns, the crown of Torah and the crown of worldly accomplishment, and neither one came to the detriment of the other. Again, is that totally true? Is it true that neither one came to the detriment of the other? Now remember, it's not totally true, because we still have the Gemara that says that in Ezra, Mordechai was number 4. And in Nehemiah, he's number 5. Because you know what? When you make decisions, there are collateral circumstances, collateral damage to your decisions. Whenever you choose A, by definition, you're giving up B. That's just the nature of life. So did Mordechai give up hours of learning? Of course he did. Did he give up a certain amount, perhaps, of sanctity or holiness, immersing himself in the outside world? Of course he did. So at the end of the day, does he take a hit for his decision? 1,000%. He goes from slot 4 to slot 5. Does that mean it was wrong? Absolutely not. Does that mean it's right? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, what Mordechai did is he made the best decision he could. I just want to end by showing you one interesting halacha. If you take a look at number, just finish. If you take a look at 23 and 24, the Gemara says something very interesting. The Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, krach v'chala samuchlo v'chala nira imonidon kekrach." Let me give you a little bit of background to this. So, the halacha is like this: walled cities read on the 15th of Adar, the 15th of Adar, and unwalled cities read on the 14th of Adar. So the Gemara says a fascinating halacha that if I live in a walled city, and there's another city that could be seen from my walled city, but it's not walled. It's not walled, right? So I'm living in city A, which is walled, and city B is on top of the hill over there. I could see it from mine. City B, which is unwalled, has the status of what? City A, a walled city, we'll read on the 15th. Similarly, if I'm in city A, walled city, and city B is in the valley, so I can't see it, but it's right outside my city, it also has the status of a walled city and reads on the 15th. The obvious question is, what the heck is going on over here? Right? Why are you playing these games? Right? Why don't you just say simply, a walled city reads on the 15th, and an unwalled city reads on the 14th. Why do you have to start? The Gemara gets into Nira and Samuch. If you have an unwalled city that can be seen from a walled city, then it has the status of a walled city. Or if you have a city that's Samuch, that's close to a walled city, then it's... Why? I mean, let's be honest. Judaism is complicated enough. There is absolutely no need to further complicate this with these unnecessary halachas. Remember, as they always say, the beauty of halacha is that halacha is never a series of do's and don'ts. Halacha always has deeply embedded philosophical, moral, ethical. So what are Chazal saying? There are two major lessons from the Purim story. The concept of nirin and the concept of smuchin. Nirin says what? That if I could see the city from the walled city, then it's like a walled city. What does nirin represent? Vision. And what does smuchin represent? Smuchin means it's next to, but I can't see it. Perception. Purim is all about the ability to perceive things that may not be obvious and to see things that are not necessarily right in front of you. If you want to know the entire message of the Megillah, it's this very point. In the post-prophetic age, There's no script. In the post-prophetic age, there are no explicit instructions. In the post-prophetic age, there is no Vayedaber Hashem, fill in your name here, Lemor. It doesn't happen. So how do you navigate? How do you get around? How do you succeed in this world? So the answer, of course, is that even though there's no explicit word, there are always signs. There are always messages. There are always hints. There are always things that happen all around us that are signs, signposts from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We just have to live our life with our eyes wide open to be able to perceive them. And we have to take, you have to have the maturity, the independence, and the confidence in ourselves to make the right decisions and to be able to do sometimes what we know needs to be done in a particular circumstance. Even if what? Even if it's never done, been done before, and even if it may be unpopular with some. That's the maturity, independence, and confidence that we have to have in this world. So what are Chazal doing? They're trying to make our life more complicated with Nirin and Tzluchin. No, they're teaching us a lesson. That in the post-prophetic world, you have to be a person who's Nira. You have to be a person with vision. You have to be able to assess the world around you, the circumstances around you, and only after that assessment, make educated life decisions. And smuchin, you have to have the power of perception. A person has to live life with a heightened sensitivity, because in the world of gray, in the world of ambiguity, in the post-prophetic world, nothing is explicit. And man has to live life with his antenna always up to try to figure out what to do. We'll never know if Mordechai was right or if Mordechai was wrong. We'll never know what he could have been had he gone ahead and withdrawn from the outside world and devoted himself to the Sanhedrin. But there's one thing we can learn from. Whether his decision was right or wrong, we learn from his courage. At the end of the day, again, I apologize for being repetitive, but using the Rav's words, we learn from his courage. We learn from his maturity, we learn from his confidence. And this becomes the eternal message of the Megillah. Sometimes we are so confounded and often rendered powerless because of the grayness, ambiguity, and lack of direction that sometimes we see in the world around us. And what we have to read, and sometimes we sit back and we wait for God to act. God acted in Egypt, but God did not act in Persia. And Baltimore is a lot like more like Persia than it is like Egypt. And ultimately, again, in these circumstances in which we live, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is waiting for us to act. HaKadosh Baruch Hu waits for us to seize initiative. HaKadosh Baruch Hu waits for us to go ahead and find direction, find maturity, and have confidence in ourselves to make the right decisions. Do we often fall down? Do we often make mistakes? Of course we do. But part of the post-prophetic world is also having the confidence and the strength to get back up even once you failed. Having the confidence and strength that even if others disagree with what you're doing, if you know in your heart that it's true, that it's MS, that it's meaningful, that it's what you need to do, then you have to have the staying power and resolve to see it through. So we should hope that Emir Tzashem and the merit of coming together to learn Megillas Esther, of extrapolating from these three ending innocuous psukim, such an incredible life lesson, that Halavai Kodesh Baruch Hu should bring us the Gula, should bring us the redemption, but not the Purim redemption, because we spent too long in the world of gray ambiguity. We've spent too long in the post-prophetic world. Halavai, in the merit of taking initiative, being mature, taking responsibility, having confidence, and driving our lives in a good direction. Halavai Kodesh Baruch Hu.